From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about a black lung epidemic among the country's coal miners. NPR's Howard Berkus is joining us to tell the story he's uncovered about how toxic coal mine dust is giving rise to a deadly form of black lung that is suffocating and killing dozens of miners, and how federal regulators in the mining industry are failing to protect them. We'll be right back.
Do you work for the University of Utah? Are you a public radio nerd? Then donate to KUER through payroll deduction. Decide how much of your paycheck you'd like to put toward programming like Morning Edition, 1A, and Radio West, and the university will send your generous gift to KUER. Your contribution supports factual journalism, Utah stories, and even short films. Get started with payroll deduction by looking under the support tab at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Tomorrow night on the PBS program Frontline, NPR's Howard Berkus is telling the story of how thousands of the country's coal miners are dying in a new epidemic of black lung disease. This is a particularly nasty form of the disease, and it illustrates just how things have changed in the country's coal mines. The largest coal seams have been mined out in Appalachia, and what's left behind are these thinner seams. The problem is they're embedded in sandstone. And when you cut into sandstone, you create silica dust. Howard explains in his reporting that these silica particles are fine and powdery, so they're easily inhaled, but they're also barbed and they're sharp. And they lodge in a miner's lungs and they never come out. You get enough of those particles in your lungs, you get black lung disease, and you slowly suffocate. Howard Berkus is joining us today to talk about his reporting and how federal regulators and mining companies have failed to protect these miners, thousands of whom are now dying. Howard Berkus is a correspondent for the NPR Investigations Unit. Tomorrow night, the PBS program Frontline is airing the documentary based on Howard's reporting. We'll give you details about that a little bit later on the program. Howard told us he began focusing on the mining industry in his reporting back in 2010.
When the Upper Big Branch coal mine in West Virginia blew up and 29 miners were killed, and my colleague Frank Langfitt was the labor reporter at NPR at the time, and he went to West Virginia to kind of look at what was going on at the company and what was wrong with the federal regulatory process if this sort of thing could happen. And he called me up and asked me to come work with them. I was the rural correspondent at the time, and he figured I would know my way around communities that might otherwise be hostile to reporters. Right away, we went up and down hollers, you know, these narrow valleys in West Virginia, knocking on the doors of coal miners and sharing contacts that we both had. And I think you know, that first week we started breaking stories. We discovered the federal criminal investigation that was underway. And so that was the start. And there's a connection to black lung there because after a year or so of investigation, there were reports on what happened. And one of the investigation reports referred to the autopsies of the miners who were killed. There were 29 miners killed. There were 24 autopsies that were looked at for the presence of black lung disease among the miners. And the rate of black lung in those miners was 70%. Well, that's 10 times the rate for black lung disease in West Virginia. And some of those miners with black lung had worked less than 10 years or less in mining. One had worked only 5 years. And they were young guys. A few of them were young. So this was a very shocking ancillary finding. So it was really a second tragedy. And that got me started on the issue of black lung. It was that prompted me to pair up with the Center for Public Integrity and Chris Hamby over there. And we did a series of stories in 2012 looking at what we documented as a resurgence of black lung disease.
Yeah. You've talked in your reporting about receiving a tip. Was there a particular tip that got you started on this particular story?
Yeah, so we reported in 2012 on the resurgence of basic black lung disease. I went off to do other stories. And in 2016, I received a text message in the summer of 2016 from a longtime source of mine, a confidential source, which basically said that legal and medical clinics in the region in Appalachia were just slammed with minors who were suffering from the worst stages of black lung disease, progressive massive fibrosis, and that this was a shocking thing. Within 2 days, three phone calls, I pretty much had this nailed. Where I talked to clinicians who had dozens and dozens of cases that they were dealing with at this advanced stage of black lung in a time frame that the official federal count of disease was 99 cases. And there was one small clinic in Kentucky where the radiologist there had identified, I think it was about 60 cases in just that one little clinic in half the time that the federal agency that tracks the disease had reported 99 cases nationwide.
Yeah.
So I knew there was something very serious going on, you know, right off the bat.
And you found exponentially more than 99, upwards of 2,000 cases you identified.
We started our own survey of black lung legal and medical clinics actually across the country. The latest count is more than 2,300 cases of progressive massive fibrosis in just six Appalachian states. The latest numbers from the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health, NIOSH, for their national count is 115. So in the same time frame that they've counted 115 cases, we've counted over 2,300. And there's, you know, there's an explanation for that difference.
What is the explanation?
The explanation is that by law, NIOSH is only permitted to test working coal miners for disease. And they test tens of thousands of them, but the testing is voluntary under the law. Well, it turns out the participation rate is relatively low. It's 35% nationally. Mm. And in eastern Kentucky, which is one of the heaviest coal mining regions, it's only 17%. So most miners aren't getting tested, and they're not testing miners who've retired or who have been laid off. And because there have been tens of thousands of jobs lost in coal mining in the last 8 years, more and more miners, once they get laid off and once they're retired, then they go in to get tested because they don't have an income anymore, and they want to file for black lung benefits. If they have the disease, they can get federal benefits, so they go in to get tested. They tend not to get tested while they're working. Hmm. For a couple of reasons. One is they're afraid that if the coal mine company finds out that they have disease, they'll get fired. And another reason is that a lot of them just don't want to know. They want to keep working because, you know, they're good jobs. You know, once they're laid off, once they're retired, there's no disincentive to get tested, and many of them do. So that's the difference. You know, the federal research program was picking up working miner population that decided to get tested, and that's a very small percentage. We were picking up what the clinics were seeing, which were people who tired and laid off mostly, and that's the big difference.
But what good does it do for a government agency just to look at one segment of the population if you're trying to identify the truth of a situation or an actual epidemic or the reality of the situation? What good does that even do?
Well, that is the key point here on this whole issue of actually getting a hold of how much disease there is.
Is it because they don't want to know?
No. It's because they're restricted by law.
Okay.
So the way the law is written, that's all they can do.
Law that's influenced by industry.
A law that was created in 1969, and there are a variety of reasons for why it is the way it is. Some people are now saying there should be a mandatory testing of all coal miners throughout their career. Now, that's also not permitted by law. And the reason is that
even though that seems really obvious, but keep going.
Right now it seems like a pretty good idea if you want to, you know, because there are miners who are working now. Who have black lung disease and don't know it, and it's going to get worse. And at least if they knew it, they would have the option to say, okay, I got to stop working. Or under the law, they actually can exercise a right to work in a dust-free area of a mine or work on the surface. And the mining company has to provide that and pay them what they were paying, you know, in the regular job. So that option exists, but if they don't know it, you know, what are they going to do? But the reason is that you know, there's this principle in this country that you don't force people to undergo medical procedures unless they want to.
Yeah.
And so there is an effort right now. The National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health, at the direction of Congress, is actually reviewing this whole system and looking at why miners aren't getting tested. And they're going to report to Congress in the spring. And then it'll be up to Congress to come up with a solution on that front.
Let's talk about Danny Smith. He's one of the miners you talked to, one of the many miners you've talked to over the years. And the Frontline documentary begins with Danny mowing his lawn or trying to mow his lawn, something he says he's always done all his life. But nowadays, of course, it's a struggle. He needs to wear a mask. He needs to take breaks for oxygen. He's only been mining for 12 years, had been mining for 12 years. He's only 47 years old. And in this moment from the documentary, he talks about how he's reacting to what's happening to him.
I started getting shortness of breath around 2007, 2006. I could tell a difference in just the things that I was doing around here.
Do you want me to get this?
The oxygen, yeah, I need it. And in 2012, I believe it was, they'd done a CT scan, and they seen all the spots on my lungs. They said, it's black lung. You're eating up a black lung. I put me in a hospital. Well, I had 30-some pounds of fluid on me, on my lungs.
I'm not feeling good today, baby. Didn't sleep good.
I was scared. It was tough on all of us because my wife was scared that I was dying, and I was scared that I was dying, and I was.
Can you turn that oxygen on back there? Just pull that little green handle, just pull it like towards you. There we go. Now I gotta get it on my face.
I think about all the hours that I worked. I was under 1 month. I never come outside for 4 days. I actually slept on the ground. And you sit and think about that and all the things that I give up with my family. You know, I work in anywhere from 12 to 18 hours a day. Dying over it now, you know what I'm saying?
Hello, give me a kiss.
What's going on with Danny? Tell me what's happening, because you can hear him struggling to breathe and talk. So just start there. What is happening?
Yeah, there's a lot. In that scene, he's taking his daughter to school. She's a senior in high school, and she's carrying his oxygen tank out to the pickup truck. And then she turns on the oxygen tank in the car, in the truck, and then helps him put the breathing tube over his ears. She, by the way, has decided she wants to become a pulmonologist because of what her dad is going through. Danny starts out, the scene starts out, he's mowing his lawn. And almost every miner I've talked to with this disease, and I've interviewed about 36 miners dying from this disease, they all talk about mowing the lawn as a benchmark of how their lives have changed. For Danny, there's a section of his lawn. He can use a riding mower for most of it, but there's a section he has to – a steep section he uses a push mower. And he says it used to take him, you know – 10 minutes or so to mow that, now takes him 6 hours because he has to stop. He has to rest. He has to put on his oxygen. When I was with him, you don't see this in the film, but you hear it in the radio story. When I was with him, he pushed that lawnmower for maybe 15 feet, turned it off, and he kind of collapsed, and he's down on his knees, and he starts hacking, and he he spits up dead lung tissue.
Yeah.
Right there on the lawn. There's a little black, crusty stuff.
And it's peeling away.
It's peeling away from his lungs. His lung tissue is dying so fast, it just peels away, and he spits it up every once in a while. So what's happening there is we see how this you'll see in the film, you look at Danny, he doesn't look like an old, broken down miner.
No, he's 47.
He's 47. He's relatively young looking anyway, there with his daughter, just trying to do the simplest things in his life, and they are increasingly difficult to do. And that is true for every single miner that we spoke with.
One of the pulmonologists you talked to said that this particular type of black lung, it leaves the lungs crusty and useless. These fibrotic masses. So what happens? I mean, you eventually suffocate? You eventually die? I mean, that's the end point for it.
That pulmonologist describes it as suffocating while alive. What happens is that in this case, what we're talking about with this advanced stage of disease, it's believed that what has caused it is exposure to toxic silica dust during the mining process. That's a result of cutting more rock with coal. As coal seams have gotten thinner in Appalachia, the big seams get played out. Coal seams are thinner. Those seams are embedded in rock and sandstone, and that sandstone contains quartz. And when you cut quartz with the coal, you're creating these particles of silica dust. They're really tiny. They're really sharp. They're really easily inhaled. And because they're sharp, they just lodge in the lungs, and the lungs cannot expel them. And so to fight back...
That's the new part of this story, we
right.
should say, right?
Right. I mean, this disease, this has been known for a century
yep.
or more.
As you've talked
about, yep. But that's what's been happening. That's why there's so much disease now, is this change in the way mining took place and the presence of silica in mine dust and the inhalation of that. And so those silica particles, they lodge in the lungs. The lung tries to fight, back, builds up fibrotic tissue. That's the way the lung fights back. Well, that fibrotic tissue basically compromises the function of the lung, and the lung basically become the capacity of the lung lessens significantly. One miner described his lung x-ray as looking like, he said his lung looked like a lump of coal. I've seen what lungs with progressive massive fibrosis look like that have been taken out for lung transplants or in autopsies. And one that I saw, the lung basically looked like a burnt up paper bag. It's irreversible. It's untreatable. You can't do anything to fix it. And so slowly the lung capacity diminishes, and it becomes harder and harder and harder to breathe until you can't breathe anymore.
You tell the story of there's an interesting story about a man named Brandon Crum, a radiologist who starts seeing these cases one after the other, after the other, after the other. Tell a little bit about him, because he brings this information to NIOSH and they have a hard time believing what they're seeing.
Yeah, Dr. Crum comes from a coal mining family in Kentucky. He's in Pikeville, Kentucky. He's the one who really first raised the alarm. He was also, like my second or third phone call. His name came up right away when I started exploring this. And he has that clinic in Kentucky where there were these 60 cases he was seeing in 18 months. And he was just flabbergasted by seeing so much disease. And miners who were his age, he's in his early 40s, he was just completely flabbergasted. So he goes to a black lung conference in West Virginia, and there are NIOSH epidemiologists there, and he goes up to them and he tells them what's going on. And one of the NIOSH epidemiologists is in the film,
yeah.
and he says, "We didn't believe him." Because NIOSH hadn't counted that many cases, and they didn't believe him. So what they did was they went to his clinic and they looked at the x-rays themselves. And as is described in the film, they just looked at x-ray after x-ray after x-ray. And Scott Laney, the NIOSH epidemiologist, who's the big expert on this stuff at NIOSH, said they were the worst x-rays he'd ever seen. And that really, they were shocked, and they launched a formal study of his clinic And he said we suspected that it wasn't just that. You know, I knew within 2 days after getting that tip that there were way more cases than Brandon Crum was finding in his little clinic in Kentucky, because there was one not far away, a set of three clinics not that far away in Virginia, and they had hundreds of cases. And they hadn't told anybody, you know, necessarily. I mean, I was the first person they told about this, and wow, the first to report it. And NIOSH was completely stunned about that. And they had sent a SWAT team of epidemiologists to that clinic. And they just did it. They went in and looked at a sample of the x-rays. They had independent blind review of those x-rays. And they came up with like 415 positive readings of progressive massive fibrosis, which, you know, that's four times what they had found in their own studies in the same time frame. Right. So that clinic now has a count that's over 800 cases, and they're still diagnosing a dozen a month. So, you know, what we've reported continues.
Howard Berkus, he's a correspondent for NPR's Investigations Unit. Tomorrow night, PBS's Frontline is showing a documentary based on Howard's reporting. It's called Cole's Deadly Dust. You can see it at 9 on KUED Channel 7. You can also see it on February 11th when KUER and KUED will be hosting a special screening. You can get details about that on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West from KUER.
KUER is a family, so let's stay in touch. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and we'll keep you in the know about breaking news happening in Utah. We'll invite you to films and parties, and you'll even see funny pictures of us sometimes. Best of all, we'll get to hear from you. Tell us what you care about in your community, and get to know your fellow public radio nerds. Follow KUER on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're telling the troubling story of a black lung disease epidemic among the country's coal miners. NPR's Howard Berkus is joining us to tell the story he's uncovered of how toxic coal mine dust is giving rise to a deadly form of black lung. The documentary is airing on the PBS program Frontline tomorrow night. It's called Cole's Deadly Dust. We'll give you more details about that a little bit later on the program. It was interesting to hear in your reporting that as an occupational hazard, mine dust goes back into antiquity.
Pliny the Elder talked about mine dust and how it affects the lungs. And they had some sort of animal bladders or something that they would put across their faces as masks to diminish the exposure. There is absolutely nothing new about anything that we've reported in terms of the hazard of mine dust and silica dust in particular, and even the impacts on human beings. And there were studies done back 100 years ago in 1908 that looked specifically at this. And the Mine Safety Agency itself in 1995 and 1996, I got a hold of some internal memos that show that the agency itself had identified a cluster of severe lung disease among coal miners in West Virginia. They were quite alarmed by it in these memos. And they even sent out a warning to the mining industry saying that miners are getting sick with advanced disease resulting from exposure to silica dust in coal mining. You know, you should do something about it. But what didn't happen was any further regulation of silica in particular.
It was interesting. There was alarm expressed during the Clinton administration,
right,
you report about. And Clinton, I'm just thinking of the political dimensions of the story, which are really interesting, and we'll get back to Donald Trump appealing to coal miners, of course. But Clinton met with coal miners who were experiencing black lung, and they called him, he's going to be our president. Like that was a really interesting part of the story, I thought.
Yeah. And we talk about this in our radio story,
yeah,
that you can refer to at NPR.org. Bill Clinton met with coal miners in Beckley, West Virginia, as a candidate for president. And he had represented miners with black lung disease and black lung claims cases in Arkansas. So he knew, you know, he I don't remember the exact quote, but first of all, he knew how sick they were getting and how terrible this was. And he said that how a government reacted to miners with this disease was sort of the difference between what a caring government would do and what an uncaring government would do. And in his administration, there were attempts to directly address silica through a rulemaking process, or there was the intent to do that.
Yeah.
But there were a couple of other things going on. There were Republicans in the House at the time who were trying to dismantle the Mine Safety and Health Administration, an anti-regulatory thing going on. The mining industry opposed any attempt to toughen regulations on coal mine dust and successfully sued. There was one element of the plan that they sued over, and they won. It didn't have anything to do with silica in particular, but it delayed everything. So that I mean, they even had during the Clinton administration a campaign against silica, which was all voluntary. But, you know, they were unable to get a new regulation through. And so the administration ended without any change in the rules. And, you know, what was happening is that mining was changing, but the regulations didn't keep up.
Yeah.
So there was the new threat, really, from silica. But the way that they tried to control silica didn't change.
I wanted to ask you about why they didn't change, because this is one of the things you get at in your reporting, or try to get at in your reporting, talking to officials as to why you don't separately regulate for silica. If we know this, talk a little bit about that. I mean, what is going on? I mean, there's some anti-regulation politics going on, but also you mentioned the National Mining Association, the lobbying organization. I mean, this could affect bottom lines, I guess, as well.
Well, there's an interesting twist in that the National Mining Association, during the Obama administration, actually advocated for direct regulation of silica. There's a political side to that, which is that what was happening at the time is that the Obama administration was engaged in a monumental rulemaking where they were going to change the way that coal mine dust was regulated in mines, and they were going to make the limits on overall coal mine dust quite a bit tougher. The industry hated that.
Yeah.
And what they decided was, well, the problem's really silica with new disease, so let's focus on silica. And what that would have done, practically speaking, was focus the new regulatory scheme only on those places where silica was a problem and only in those mines where silica was a problem, which would be Central Appalachia. And whereas the other overall approach that the Mine Safety Agency was taking would have affected mines elsewhere in the country. And the biggest coal mining state is Wyoming. So you had a situation in which the mining companies who weren't in Appalachia didn't want to have tougher regulation, especially if the problem was silica. You know. You know, throughout the decades, I think there were two things going on. I think one, the Mine Safety and Health Administration, the agency that, you know, protects coal miners, is supposed to protect coal miners, either didn't see what we saw in their own data. We looked at their, you know, 30 years of their data. We could see that there were thousands and thousands and thousands of exposures to toxic silica dust at dangerous levels beyond what were permitted. It showed up in their own testing of mine dust. It was you know, maybe 15% of all of the tests that were done. So it might have looked like, well, we're doing good. 85% of the time, we meet the silica limit. So we're doing okay,
yeah.
Right? But, you know, the problem is with something like this is that 15% actually represented 21,000 exposures of excessive silica dust, which is 20 times more toxic than coal dust alone.
And there's only 50,000 miners in the country.
Well, now there are.
Right. Not then.
Then, you know, there were...
But that seems like a significant proportion still, no?
So to me, it's not, you know, it's not a matter of what the rate is, because it's deadly.
Yeah.
21,000 exposures. You know, that's over 30 years. I mean, you can do all kinds of mathematical calculations to minimize that number. But because silica is so toxic, because it's so easily inhaled, because the sampling of mine dust is done a fraction of the time, because we know that mines are probably in their best conditions when mine inspectors show up. The mining company wants it to be the cleanest at that time. Many miners told us all these things that were done to do that. So we know that that 21,000 exposures is probably, way underrepresented what actually would happen,
yeah.
Right? But if there were 21,000 instances of miners being exposed to toxic silica dust, and if those silica particles are going to lodge in their lungs forever, to me, that's pretty significant. And that can explain why there are, 2,300 miners that we know about so far that have disease now. Because those miners, they were working during this time period.
Yeah.
And the other things that we found in their own data was there's a regulatory response. If you have too much silica in the mine dust samples, then there's this formula that kicks in, and the mine is put on a lower limit for overall coal mine dust, not for silica in particular, but overall dust, which is coal dust.
It looks complicated, this formula.
It is complicated.
Yeah.
And what it does is it diminishes the impact of silica. But we decided to take a look at that. Okay, so they applied the formula. You can look at the data. You can see this. So how many times after they applied the formula, which was, the idea was, okay, we'll lower the limit on overall coal mine dust exposure, and then that'll bring down the silica to an acceptable level. Well,
yeah.
We looked at that. We found that didn't work 9,000 times. That 9,000 times, even after they applied the regulatory response, there was still too much silica. And then the other measure we found that we thought was interesting was mine inspectors didn't often over the years issue citations for too much silica. But when they did, we looked at that. And they note whenever there's a citation, the mine inspector notes how many people are affected by this violation. So again, we're talking about silica dust, very toxic, easily inhaled. And what we found that in those citations, they said 9,000 miners were affected. So why didn't the agency think that was significant? I'm not sure. They thought they were doing the right thing all these years. Now, I need to add that the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health, beginning in 1974, recommended a limit on silica exposure for coal mines that was twice as tough. And in 1996, NIOSH and a Labor Department advisory committee both recommended not only a tougher limit on silica, but direct regulation, not using this formula. But if there's too much silica, then you deal with it directly. That was recommended in the 1990s. None of that ever happened. And you have the former head of mine safety and health in the United Mine Workers Union running the regulatory agency, mm-hmm. has this, huge coal mine dust regulatory rule put into place. Silica is not in there. And when you ask him about it, what he says is, well, we thought that would fix it, even though it hadn't fixed it, in those previous 30 years. So I don't have a good explanation as to why they didn't do what the data suggested they should do and what they were specifically urged to do by NIOSH, by this Labor Department Advisory Committee. I don't know.
You had a conversation with a man named Bruce Watzman, who's a vice president with the National Mining Association. And I wanted to play a moment from this. You were suggesting to him, as you will hear right up front of this particular clip, you're talking about, look, there were things that could have been done, that mining could have done. I want to play this and his response.
You can slow down the mining machines. You can maybe cut production a little bit so that you're not generating as much dust. Or maybe you decide that you don't cut so much rock and you don't cut those thinner seams. Aren't those things that mining companies could have done? You don't need regulation to do that.
Sure, they could have done that. But again, Howard, I'm not going to speculate on why they did or didn't do what they chose. Our focus here is forward-looking. How do we prevent this in the future? I can't answer for what occurred in the past. Were we really focusing on the right thing? MSHA had a mantra, end black lung. and we support that. But coal dust might not have really been where the focus should have been at that time. It might have been silica rather than coal dust.
What do you make of that response?
Well, I asked the question the way I did because when the mining process involves cutting the rock that produces silica, it slows the mining process down. So the mining companies know when they're cutting more rock, it affects them. Also, when you start mixing rock and coal together, you can't sell the coal without taking the rock and silica dust out of it. So they knew, you know, and of course they know when they're cutting more rock, the seams are thinner. So to me, it seems to be a reasonable question to ask, especially again, because the danger from silica was well known. The mining industry was directly warned in the 1990s that this was happening. Under the law, coal mining companies are responsible for the health and safety of miners. So they had a legal responsibility. They have a moral responsibility to protect those miners.
What he's saying is, let's not relive the past, and we'll go forward and do.
He's also saying the regulators didn't make us do anything different, and but let's not look to the past,
yeah.
Right?
Is anything being done in the future? Is the question, I guess.
Well, let me get to that in a second.
Yeah,
I've done a lot of stories in my career in which the first response is, well, let's not dwell on the past. You know, that happened during the Challenger explosion. Let's not look, you know, let's not find blame. Let's not look in the past. When a bureaucrat or a corporate official says that, it means they don't want to dig up the failures. And to me, and I said this, it's not in the film, but it's in the radio piece. I said to Bruce Watzman, well, how can you know what to do in the future if you don't understand what happened in the past? But yeah, he's deflecting from the responsibility that industry has to protect its workers. So he talks about the future. And he did mention that the industry said that the focus should be on silica, and the industry did take that position. What he also says is that they're doing better now. And the current data from coal mines shows that 99% of the time, mining companies are complying with the limits for silica and for coal dust, which looks great. The problem is that they're still only testing a fraction of the time. It's unclear what is happening when the inspectors aren't there, which is 99% of the time they're not there. And it doesn't take a lot of exposure to silica to cause a problem. It's also the way that they sample for mine dust. They're not necessarily picking up on what are episodic bursts of intense exposure that happens in the mining process. And miners talk about this a lot. So it's not necessarily an accurate representation. And because the disease takes at least, you know, 5-10 years to develop, and 10 years before you know it's really bad, it's going to be a while before we know whether the regulatory process that exists now is still working the way it should be. But the bottom line is they still haven't directly addressed silica.
Something really stood out to me in the report for NPR, where there are regulations for silica for every industry that cuts rock, except for mining.
Yeah. The Occupational Safety and Health Administration, which regulates every industry basically except mining, adopted a new silica rule during the Obama administration. By the way, they worked on that for 44 years. It took them 44 years to get that done. There was stiff industry resistance. There are also some politics underway. And part of what MSHA was doing during the Mine Safety and Health Administration was doing during the Obama administration on silica was, and they actually said this, they said, we'll hold off on doing anything about silica because OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, is already working on it. And a rulemaking process is a pretty complicated process. You have to present studies, and there's a lot of work to be done. And so they were saying, we'll let them do all that work, and then they'll adopt their rule, and then we'll take all the work they've done, and we'll use it to adopt our rule, you know, and we'll focus on silica. They actually said this. The problem is that during the Obama administration, there were political delays in OSHA actually coming forth with that rule. I think it was because the administration, the Obama administration, was especially sensitive to doing anything that might hurt the chances of reelection and might hurt the chances of Democrats getting elected. And they knew that there was this anti-regulatory atmosphere out there. And so they proceeded, you know, carefully, cautiously. And that silica rule didn't go into effect for all those industries except coal mining until the very end of the administration. And then it was too late, you know, for the miners. But you have to ask yourself, if it's so dangerous for every industry in this country that cuts rock, except coal mining, where there actually, you could argue, is very predictable exposure to this disease by the way that mining takes place now, then why wouldn't you do it for mining too? You know, like, what is the difference between a coal miner exposed to silica dust and a, somebody cutting, you know, granite? The human beings are the same.
I want to ask you about kind of an extraordinary moment in the film when you finally have an opportunity to talk to an assistant secretary of labor for mine safety and health, David
Zeteslo.
You had to track him down basically at a conference in, I guess this was in West Virginia. And no one had been responding to your requests for interviews. Set this up for us. So basically, he starts saying in this conference something that surprised you. He was saying silica is the problem. It's different. He was quite explicit about that.
Right. So David Zeteslo, the head of the Mine Safety and Health Administration, was making a rare public appearance at the Mining Engineering School at West Virginia University in September. And I had actually been tracking his public appearances, which are easy to track because there's almost none, because no one at the agency would talk to us. And we spent, over the course of a year, we had many, many interview requests with people at all levels, including Zeteslo, the Assistant Secretary of Labor. And so when I saw that he was making this appearance, and he was doing an honorary lecture, you know, at the school. So it was a lecture, and he was presenting slides and an update on what MSHA was up to. And in the middle of this lecture, he mentioned, he knows we're in the audience too, by the way. He mentions, and he knows what we're working on. He mentions progressive massive fibrosis, and he says, and I believe the cause is silica. And
he said that, were you stunned?
Yeah, I nearly fell off my chair. So we went up to him afterwards to ask him about it.
Mr. Zeteslo, I'm Howard Berkus from National Public Radio and PBS Frontline. We've been interested in talking to you about progressive massive fibrosis and the epidemic of disease. I'm wondering why you're unwilling to speak with us about that. We've had multiple requests for interviews, ready to talk to you today, next week, in the past.
I don't think the science is that well defined on it yet, Howard.
You have 2,000 miners right now.
Don't think that the science of the causation is that well defined.
You said yourself that silica was...
No, I said I suspect silica.
We've interviewed dozens of coal miners, and they've told us about their experiences. They all have progressive massive fibrosis. They're all dying from this disease. So they've talked about their experiences.
I'm supposed to go up here to this picture.
So why won't you talk to us about this issue?
Because I don't think the science is settled on.
What has that got to do with it? You have so much experience in this field, as you just described, and you described all these deaths that are occurring.
Okay, let me put it this way. I won't talk to you about it because I'm supposed to go be in a picture right now.
Excuse me, students, are
waiting. He never did come back and talk to you anyway, right?
Oh, no. He disappeared to have a dinner with the students. And the audience, by the way, also included mining company executives and mining industry lobbyists, as well as the students from the mining engineering school. I knew going into that we were not going to have a substantive interview with him. And it wasn't going to be satisfactory in terms of getting an answer. But the fact that he directly contradicted himself was kind of interesting. And, we've heard nothing from the agency since. Although I did get an email the other day asking what my retirement date is.
Really?
Yeah. I don't know, until we have the opportunity to sit down with David Zetesloh, we won't really know why he said what he said, why he said the science isn't in on it yet.
But do the epidemiologists, the government epidemiologists, say there is actually causation here?
Not only the epidemiologists, but the pulmonologists who have been looking at this for decades. And the studies that NIOSH has completed in the past, there's quite a body of scientific research which concludes that silica causes disease. There's no question that silica causes disease. The industry doesn't take the position that silica is not the problem. And the agency itself, in internal memos, in press releases in the past, has made that connection. There are some studies underway to look at the geology of various coal seams to see what's going on there and to see if there's something else that might be also in the coal and in the silica dust that could cause advanced disease, whether certain coal seams are more likely to cause disease than others. Although I have to tell you, I've interviewed miners who've worked in coal seams from Pennsylvania to Tennessee and in Ohio who have this disease. And there also is a study underway to look at autopsies that have been done of coal miners who've developed this disease. If there is lung tissue available, they'll look at that. And to look at lungs that have been taken out of miners when they go in for lung transplants to see what the mineral content is of that fibrotic tissue. So there's some work being done on that as well. All of that spurred by our reporting in 2016.
You mentioned this earlier that at this Stone Mountain Healthcare Clinic in Virginia, the clinics there, they're seeing something like a dozen new cases a month. I wanted to play a conversation you had or a moment with Ron Carson. He's the former director at Stone Mountain. Would you talk a little bit about what the message that he's giving? Because he talks in this clip we'll play about the fact that these men have been forgotten and that they're the ones that have been paying this price. He gets, as you'll hear, kind of emotional here.
Yeah, Ron Carson has worked with coal miners at these black lung clinics in southwestern Virginia for 30 years, and can't talk about this without thinking about what miners have, in his mind, sacrificed.
I just think that America needs to know that these miners, they have paid a price. So many years, these miners extract this coal so that you and I can get dairy. They pay the price. They have paid the price so that we can have luxury. And I just feel like America has just forgotten about them.
What do you see going forward on this story?
So far, there has been a response from Congress. The House Labor Committee will hold hearings. And so those hearings may help shed some light. The Mine Safety and Health Administration chief will have to testify at those hearings, or will be asked to testify at those hearings. I'm sure he will. So maybe there'll be a better explanation of why the agency, at least during the current administration, has not proposed to do anything specifically about silica in coal mines. It would take Congress, or it could Congress could act. Congress could do something. It's not likely to happen in a Congress that's split between a Democratic House and a Republican Senate. And the Republican lawmakers from the coal mining states have not reacted to this reporting with any in any way, really. I mean, we've heard no reaction. There is one bipartisan bill that supports the idea of figuring out why more miners aren't getting tested. And there has been some bipartisan support for providing more funds to black lung clinics that are now treating more miners and sicker miners. That's been bipartisan. But I think hearings will help focus attention on this idea of more direct and stronger regulation of silica. So maybe something would happen then.
NPR's Howard Berkus. He's a correspondent for the NPR Investigations Unit. Tomorrow night, PBS's Frontline is showing the documentary based on his reporting. It's called Coal's Deadly Dust. You can see it at 9 o'clock on KUED Channel 7. And then on February 11th, KUER and KUED are going to be holding a special screening of the documentary. You can get details about all of that on our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.